So today I want to talk a bit about some principles from psychology that have application to the whole discussion of healing and self-transformation, down to the roots of mind or personal mind that are associated with the willingness and the capacity to change or learn. The capacity, we're talking about self-transformation. It's all about directed change, directed self-changing, self-directed self-changing, particularly transformation of mind, which we talked about healing and initiation. We talked about clearing lower chakra blockages, sure, or getting beyond distortions or psychopathology, neurosis in the mind. Knowing oneself, know yourself, accept yourself, become a creator. Before you become the creator or realize all is one, there's a whole lot of self-directed self-transformation required. Even if there's no solid self, this body-mind-spirit complex is the self we seem to be having or working with. And yet we get stuck in patterns all the time. We have distortions in mind associated with chakra blockages as yet unreleased, or blocks unhealed, blockages that have not been cleared. And there's a pace, we all have a certain pace or speed by which we can facilitate continued self-transformation. So I want to look at the page on Wikipedia associated with the two terms ego syntonic and ego dystonic. I want to look at the Wikipedia page on tonic, the use of the word tonic in physiology, which is different than gin and tonic. And maybe I want to draw from a page written by a German man who became a monk in Chiang Mai, it seems, writing about anatta or no self or non-ego. So we start with Western psychology and particularly Freud and psychoanalysis using the term ego, which indeed may well have not been as we think of it today, meaning myself is this ego is self, and we gotta clear the ego, heal the ego, destroy the ego, purify the ego, whatever that our views may be. That may not be the same as how Freud used it. As somebody said, it may be the a fragment or an aspect of the total self, which seems very reasonable, bearing in mind Buddha or Gautama's understanding that there is no solid self, and yet it's a useful concept to some degree. Ross said that ego, we find this concept unworkable and understanding cannot come from it. So holding the concept of ego tightly, assuming that ego is myself, that has to be, is a solid structure in the mind or in the being that needs to be worked on, that's unworkable, according to Ra. And understanding, or fourth chakra activation, or harvest ability, or further heart-based positive path development can't come from working with this concept ego. I agree. However, if we hold the term ego very loosely, as simply the sense of self, not a substantial structure or substantial entity within the mind or something, then I think we can develop understanding. And from the page Anatta, before we even get to the page Wikipedia, ego syntonic and ego dystonic, the definition of this is not self or non-ego or egolessness or impersonality. I would say insubstantiality also. Written first paragraph is the last of the three characteristics of existence, ti lakana. Ti lakana means three lakana, meanings three characteristics, also called the three marks. The Anatta doctrine teaches that neither within the bodily and mental phenomena of existence nor outside of them can be found anything that, in the ultimate sense, could be regarded as a self-existing real ego entity, soul, or any other abiding substance. So insubstantiality. There isn't a substantial real or objectively eternal self-entity that can be found upon analysis, something like that. Going on, this is the central, he says, this is the central, I think actually impermanence is central, but he writes that this is the central doctrine of Buddhism, without understanding of which, a real knowledge of Buddhism is altogether impossible, and I agree to a certain extent, yes. It is the only really specific Buddhist doctrine with which the entire scripture of the Buddhist teaching stands or falls. All the remaining Buddhist doctrines may, more or less, be found in other philosophic systems and religions, but the Anatta doctrine has been clearly unreservedly taught only by the Buddha. Therefore, the Buddha is known as the Anattavadi, teacher of impersonality. Anattavadi, Anattavadi, teacher. Teacher of selflessness, or teacher of the insubstantiality of selfhood. The teacher of non-ego. And, or the teacher of empty, egoic emptiness. And I would say that the central doctrine of Buddhism is impermanence, but anatta, or no self, or insubstantiality of identity. It's basically freedom from identification. The reality that there's no fixed and abiding identity that we can find as ourself, as a selfhood. That actually comes naturally from an understanding of impermanence or anicca. But it's very true, and it's a very important point, and it's very consequential that in Buddhism, that Buddhism itself is indeed the only religion or philosophic doctrine that propounds the reality of anatta, or the unreality of substantial selfhood. That's really true. And that's, people can get into trouble with this, yeah, sure. Maybe people can get into depersonalization, dissociation, self-denial, or emotional process denial. But those are problems with, using the medicine wrongly, not the medicine itself, as the teaching as medicine. Going on a little bit, and then I'm going to pull back to this after we look at ego syntonic, ego dystonic. Next paragraph. Whosoever has not penetrated this impersonality of all existence and does not comprehend that in reality there exists only this continually self-consuming process of arising and passing bodily and mental phenomena, meaning anicca, impermanence, and that there is no separate ego entity within or without this process, he will not be able to understand Buddhism. I think so too, i.e. the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, right, which is the reality of dukkha, or suffering, dissatisfaction, stress, its cause, its ending, and the way to its ending. Those are the Four Noble Truths. And will not be able to understand Buddhism, i.e. the teaching of the Four Noble Truths, in the right light. He will think that it is his ego, his personality, that experiences suffering, his personality that performs good and evil actions and will be reborn according to these actions, his personality that will enter into Nibbana, his personality that walks on the Eightfold Path. And the teaching here is that no, there is no his personality. There is no fixed selfhood, personality, personhood to be doing those things. However, those activities happen. And the quote here from Visuddhimagga 16, according to somebody's translation, quote, mere suffering, dukkha, mere suffering exists, but no sufferer is found. The deeds are, but no doer of the deeds is there. Nibbana is, but not the man that enters it. The path is, but no traveler on it is seen. Oh. And so this is actually a formulation of the Four Noble Truths in light of anatta. And anatta, no self, selflessness, as based in anicca, impermanence, as the frame by which we can understand the Four Noble Truths. So the first is the existence of suffering, or dukkha. Mere suffering, dukkha, exists. No sufferer is found. So dukkha, appears to exist, or dukkha is experienced indeed, but no entity that is experiencing the dukkha can be found if you keep looking. Indeed, look at your, find yourself, like Ramana Maharshi said, search for the ego. Good luck. See what you find. You'll find emptiness. The deeds are, but no doer of the deeds is there. And the deeds, particularly deeds that we can say, you know, his personality performing good and evil actions and rebirth according to those actions, karmic seeds are sown. Action in body, mind, and speech, meaning physical behavior and thought and speech, is occurring. But again, no fixed entity within can be found. And so, likewise, the cause of suffering is there by our deeds, or the activity of thought, word, and deed, physical. Those actions occur, but and they give rise to dukkha and suffering, of course, based on ignorance. But no doer can be found. Nibbana is the third noble truth, right, the end of suffering, but not the man, or being, or one, to enter it, indeed. And Ra talked about that too, that the adept, when the being becomes an adept and moves along the adept path, one finds that the one that started is no longer there, something like that, that the one that entered has been transformed. That's a paraphrase. So to think that you will achieve enlightenment is mistaken. If you have a thick notion of you, that those, the conceptual identity is not true being, period. And so conceptualization of identity isn't true being, or isn't our true identity. Presence, unfettered presence, is closer. The path is, but no traveler on it is seen. And so the fourth noble truth, the path to the ending of suffering, being Nibbana or Nirvana, is indeed. But there's no one, there's no fixed, separative, unchanging, or substantial entity, personhood, doing that path. Then we drop down into the lower realms, and we look at Wikipedia talking about ego syntonic, ego dystonic. And probably I'm going to keep this to just about a half hour today, and then next week we'll close it with another hour, I think. Ego syntonic, ego dystonic, Wikipedia, not a long page. These are actually critical terms. It's interesting that the page is so short. I'll read introductory paragraph, applicability, and the Freudian heritage, and try to keep my comments brief so we can pull through the whole page in 15 or 20 minutes. First paragraph, introductory. Ego syntonic and ego dystonic, D-Y-S-T-O-N-I-C. Ego syntonic and ego dystonic are terms used in psychoanalysis. Ego syntonic is a term referring to behaviors, values, and feelings that are in harmony with or acceptable to the needs and goals of the ego, or consistent with one's ideal self-image. Ego dystonic, also called ego alien, is the opposite of ego syntonic, and refers to thoughts and behaviors, e.g. dreams, impulses, compulsions, desires, etc., that are in conflict, dissonant, or dissonant with the needs and goals of the ego, or, further, in conflict with a person's ideal self-image. So we can say self-image syntonic, self-image dystonic, or self-syntonic, or self-dystonic, the sense of self. We don't have to worry about ego as illusory. The sense of self-image indeed is, or the sense of self as self-image, or the view of self, self-view, is apparently real or certainly experienced. So there's basically that which is in harmony with or acceptable to, and that which is out of harmony or not acceptable to, the sense of self. Syntonic, dystonic. Syntonicity, meaning in harmony with, with-tonicity. Dystonicity, dystonic, meaning outside or without or against tonicity, which really means physiological, in this case mental or self-image-based harmony. In harmony, out of harmony, in agreement with, out of agreement with, fitting or seen as not fitting. And so we're talking about behaviors, values, and feelings. That's what they're talking about. We're really talking about, I want to focus on how a person, the relative openness to change, the relative, the capacity of any one person at any one time to learn, to find new information, to hear truths about themselves that are not syntonic. It's easy to hear truth that you like. It's not easy to hear truth that you don't like. The liking, not liking, is that what we like is syntonic, what we don't like is dystonic. Of course, there are some people who are very stuck in self-hatred, self-blame, low self-esteem, and so they like to hear what makes them feel bad or confirms how bad they are, which is their own self-image only. So there is a healthy self-image and an unhealthy self-image, or there's a positive self-image and a negative self-image, right? There's realistic self-image and fanciful, mistaken self-image, right? So the Napoleon complex, the guy is average and he thinks he's superlative. That's a distorted self-image associated with grandiosity. Most people have that to some degree. That's a problem. Meanwhile, many people who have what could be called some degree of self-centeredness, grandiosity, unrealistic, inflated self-image, unrealistic, overvaluing or excessively what? self-cherishing self-image, like I'm thinking I'm better than I am. I'm these qualities that are valuable or good, I have all them, or I'm all that good stuff. And the other is low self-esteem. I am bad, I'm a loser, I'm a failure. And so the matter here is that there are all sorts of variations of self-image. And then there's in line with the self-image, which may be realistic or not realistic, or quite realistic but not fully, generally is the case. Or some people who are completely very unrealistic self-image or self-view. Unrealistic positive, unrealistic negative. Realistic or unrealistic, you know, when it's realistic, it's not positive or negative, it's healthy and honest. Meaning, I know my strengths, I know my weaknesses. And even if there's no my or possession, okay, fine, we can, you know, use the temporary illusion of self-psychology to move out of self-psychology. But commonly thought, realistic self-image, to me, seems to be, I know my strengths and weaknesses, good points and distortions pretty well. And I'm pretty much open to hearing what people have to say about me, or listening to criticism or constructive criticism and trying to discern the truth. I want to be realistic. I want to be honest. I want to see clearly. That means I want an accurate or realistic self-image. And I don't think a lot of people even have that commitment, but it's painful to hear things that are dystonic to the sense of self. And so what's in harmony with, what's acceptable to is syntonic, what's felt to be in conflict with or dissonant from or outside of how I think of myself or want to think of myself is dystonic. And we're talking here, you know, they talk about behaviors, values, and feelings. And I'm talking really about information about one's self-knowledge, self-understanding. Certainly, somebody who values love will feel that doing violence is ego-dystonic. That's kind of simplistic. So that's behavior. So we know some things that people don't want to do, or sometimes when we don't want to do something at the level of physical behavior, it's because it conflicts with our sense of self. Fine, there's not really a big deal on that, except if there's a conflict around it and there's a sense of, I know I should, but I don't. I know I should take care of myself better, but I don't. That's, you know, some conflict regarding that behavior, but it's really a conflict of values, it seems to me. But particularly, I'd like to focus on what is syntonic and what is dystonic in terms of self-understanding, or information that comes in, or hearing about myself, or knowing of myself more deeply, as to the degree to which any one person can have a realistic sense of self, moving towards a realistic sense of self, not strong or weak, neither arrogant nor self-depreciating, but a realistic, honest, fair, true, realistic sense of self. And that's difficult when the sense of self is fragile. So we go down. Applicability. Abnormal psychology has studied egosyntonic and egodystonic concepts in some detail. But again, I'm not going to talk about, we're not talking only about abnormal psychology. The real problem is normal psychology, which is many ways distorted. Distortions of normal psychology are much more prevalent and useful for us than those strange clinical cases of abnormal. Many personality disorders, meaning extreme mental illness, mental health cases like paranoia, obsessive-compulsive, schizophrenia, delusional, psychopathic, sociopathic, which, you know, most people are not falling into. But yes, indeed, many personality disorders are egosyntonic, meaning acceptable to the person. They don't see any different, which makes their treatment difficult, as the patients may not perceive anything wrong and view their perceptions and behavior as reasonable and appropriate. For example, a person with narcissistic personality disorder has an excessively positive self-regard and rejects suggestions that challenges this viewpoint. This corresponds to the general concept in psychiatry of poor insight. Yes, indeed, they don't know themselves so well. Going on, anorexia nervosa, meaning anorexia, a difficult-to-treat Axis 1 disorder characterized by a distorted body image and fear of gaining weight, is also considered egosyntonic because many of its sufferers deny that they have a problem. So, she's 5'4" and 80 pounds. Problem gambling, however, is sometimes seen as egosyntonic, even, depending partly on the reactions of the individual involved and whether they know that their gambling is problematic. And so, the capacity to recognize my behavior is problematic requires insight. That insight actually requires a sense of ego or self that is both strong enough to acknowledge that I'm stuck in problematic behavior, or I have distorted values and beliefs, acknowledging that there really is a problem here. One has to have a realistic enough or strong enough or strong, realistically healthy or strong enough sense of self to be able to hear any kind of view or opinion from somebody else that there's something wrong here, that my behavior or my behavior is problematic or my beliefs are wrong. And so we get this all sorts of ramifications here. There's problematic behavior, and then there are wrong beliefs. Like somebody who says, no, ego is solid, and I've got to destroy my ego to be free of suffering. You know, according to Buddhism and Advaita Vedanta and many traditions, that's a mistaken view. Even Ra talks against that kind of, the ego is solid, I've got to destroy it and kill it to be free. But some people hold it tightly, that view, and they don't think there's a problem. Because at a deeper level of mind, that fits some aspects of their self-esteem, or their self-image, their self-view. And so it's very common indeed. There's one way of talking about the difference between neurosis and psychosis. Personality disorders are associated with psychosis, not neurosis. They're a whole other order of, you know, mental mind distortion than neurosis. It's said that the neurotic builds sand castles in the sky, and the psychotic lives in them. And it's a brilliant, brilliant analogy, I think. So when we're stuck in normal level, common level mental distortion or neuroses, we make fantasy, and we keep building mistaken. We're continually creating false opinions. We're living in mistaken view, or our opinions about our understanding is mistaken. We continue creating misunderstanding, or we continue misunderstanding. Obviously, we live in that misunderstanding, but not permanently. We come and go. In the case of psychotic or personality disorders, there is a relatively permanent inhabitation of distorted opinion, or really a false self-view and worldview. View of self, view of world, is false or mistaken, and the person is is very strongly attached to them, and pretty much unable to see something beyond. And so, in that case, like living in the sandcastle in the sky, people don't think that there's anything wrong, and they feel that their, you know, perceptions are reasonable and appropriate. However, everybody is a bit psychotic. Everybody is stuck. The whole nature of misunderstanding is akin to a personality disorder, meaning it's not just the neurotic, the neurotic or the person who's not full-blown schizophrenic or paranoiac or narcissistic or OCD or delusional. It's not just that kind of person, which is called personality disorder or psychosis, that lives in their sandcastle, actually, or lives from false view. To the extent that anybody defends wrong view, any mistaken opinion or mistaken view of self or world or creation, you know, like materialism as a wrong view, or associated with ego, you know, solid self, ego, separate, that's going to die at death or be destroyed and go to the void and empty and be never more after death. That worldview, self-view, to the extent that anybody holds it, they believe it, so they live in it. Sure, they'll defend it. They may not want to hear anything else. There are very few materialists, intellectuals, skeptics, debunkers, professional debunkers, who want to hear anything else. They're convinced they're right. That's a kind of psychosis. Because actually, logically, they can't be sure they're right. They just believe they're right. And so, this kind of collective quasi-psychosis, the psychosis of the veiled 3D mind, the 3D veiled mind, with great distortion, all the way up until until insight and freedom from such distortions by, you know, awakening to the mistaken understanding and finding, you know, replacing wrong view with a more accurate view of self or world or life. Before that time of transformation, there's a sort of quasi-psychosis in the mind. People arguing for their wrong beliefs or their mistaken self-view and worldview. It happens all the time. Going further, an illustration of the differences between an ego dystonic and an ego syntonic mental disorder is in comparing obsessive compulsive disorder and obsessive compulsive personality disorder. All right, so one is neurotic, the other one psychotic or personality disorder. Obsessive compulsive disorder, not the extreme, is considered to be ego dystonic, as the thoughts and compulsions experienced or expressed are not consistent with the individual's self-perception, meaning the patient realizes the obsessions are unreasonable and are often distressed by their obsessions. In contrast, obsessive-compulsive personality disorder is ego-syntonic, as the patient generally perceives their obsession with orderliness, perfectionism, and control as reasonable and even desirable. And so that's kind of not unusual. And so the basis of how we're stuck, or us, all of us stuck wherever we're stuck with our particular configuration of lower triad blockages and our particular core beliefs associated with self and world, to whatever degree those are distorted, we're stuck, or we perpetuate those distortions. And in many ways, what that is taking that which is distorted as ego-syntonic, meaning there's an acceptability to our views, and views of self, view of world, and even value scale of values. We consider them right and good and acceptable, or true and accurate, and therefore ego-syntonic, or in harmony with who I am, who I feel I am, or how I think reality is, and don't realize that they're actually mistaken. So there's false ego-syntonicity. False or unhealthy, unskillful ego-syntonicity, which is basically regarding that which is harmful to me as that which is good for me. Gautama talked about this all the time. Taking the unskillful for skillful, and taking the harmful for harmless, and assuming that we know, or we're in the right. we are not distorted when we are distorted, or that there's no distortion when there is distortion. We think that there's no ignorance when there is ignorance. And so we become full of ourselves, or we become a bit arrogant, or we are not receptive to constructive criticism, or we become defensive, or we walk around defensive, or we're not really open-hearted. And so open-hearted is the opposite of that. And open-hearted, with wisdom, basically means I'm willing to see what's not true. And where I'm mistaken, I want to be corrected. And I'm careful before I assume I know for sure. And so then in this difference between OCD and OCPD, obsessive-compulsive personality disorder, in the one case, the person realizes there's a problem here, in the other case, the person doesn't. And that's the difference between knowing that my current understanding is limited and mistaken, or my views are perhaps mistaken, or my views are mistaken indeed, and you know more than I do, or that opinion that you're sharing is right and I've been wrong. That's very difficult for most folks, for all of us, to the extent that we have a fragile sense of self, or a sense of self that's not grounded in truth and virtue. Finally, the next section, Freudian heritage. And actually, I'm not sure. I'll just go through this quickly, and next week we'll wrap it all up. Freudian heritage. Ego-syntonic was a term, or was introduced as a term, in 1914 by Freud in On Narcissism. We can look at that sometime. And remained an important part of his conceptual armory, meaning a collection of weapons, but that's a silly way of putting it. Freud saw psychic conflict arising when, quote, the original lagging instincts come into conflict with the ego, or ego-syntonic instincts. And so this is id versus ego, or psychic conflict coming from some opposition between some desires and how the person thinks of themselves that disallows those desires, or doesn't, feels that they're it's unacceptable even to consider those desires because it conflicts with their sense of self. So desires that are considered ego dystonic, while actually they may be helpful for the person or necessary to at least consider for general, you know, better health or to be honest and well. Otto Fenichel, these guys are real old-timer psychoanalysts. Otto Fenichel distinguished between morbid impulses, which he saw as ego-syntonic, and compulsive symptoms, which struck their possessors as ego-alien. And this is dealing with people who have, you know, all sorts of super complexes, like Victorian England people who get a tic or a stutter, but associated with heavy self-repression or heavy emotion or repression of desires. So morbid impulses, which can be ego-syntonic, meaning the person allows them or feels that they're okay, and then compulsive symptoms, meaning some kind of symptomology of some serious problem that they feel is ego-alien, meaning it doesn't fit me, I don't know why this is here. So a lot of this is about integrating a deeper self-understanding and self-acceptance that integrates that which we feel is not me, but it arises in body-mind, and they don't want it. And then they do heavy repression against it. That leads to all sorts of strange symptoms, compulsive symptoms. Anna Freud stressed how differences which were defenses, which were ego-syntonic, were harder to expose than ego-dystonic impulses, because the former are familiar and taken for granted. And that's a very deep... Anna Freud, I think daughter of Freud, of Sigmund, stressed how defenses which are ego-syntonic are harder to expose than... and so defenses that are ego-syntonic really means how I don't want to hear what you... I assume you're wrong, or I assume that's not true, or I assume I'm right. But actually, the person's stuck in defense mechanism. It happens all the time. And in fact, we might want to look into that. Defenses or avoidance or ways of not seeing truth that we use to avoid changing and learning and growing and healing, yet they're ego-syntonic, meaning the person feels that's just me. I'm just this way. Or how dare you say that? Meanwhile, what's said may be true and important. So that's heavy, actually, and that's really where the problem lies, is defense mechanisms, avoidance, unwillingness to develop insight. The procedures by which we avoid insight and avoid healing and avoid self-understanding, processes which actually feel familiar and safe and we strongly support to our own detriment. That's the problem. Heinz Hartmann, and after him, eco-psychology also made central use of the twin concepts, syntonic, dystonic. Later psychoanalytic writers emphasized how direct expression of the repressed was ego-dystonic, and indirect expression more ego-syntonic. So direct expression of the repressed, people have a hard time with their catharsis. It feels alien to me. This great sorrow or anger or fear. It's felt to be dystonic, when actually it might be very helpful, but certainly doesn't fit the sense of self, the current sense of self. So a limited sense of self, the breadth and depth of the sense of self, the purity or transparency or metaphysical reality, degree of metaphysical reality of the sense of self, determines the scope of what's considered syntonic and dystonic, particularly dystonic, meaning the smaller the sense of self, the greater the range of what's considered outside what I'm willing to consider. And the greater or more honest, not narcissistic, but more honest and realistic and more metaphysically accurate the sense of self, the greater the space in which we can consider so-called ego-syntonic, or we can listen and hear and consider that the sense of self is broad and deep enough, realistic, broad and deep and realistic enough to hear much and consider much and not get defensive and upset and freaked out about things, and be willing to consider rather than reflexively reject or, you know, meet with complex, subtle defense mechanisms. And so indirect expression, more egocentric, and again, that's how the person thinks of themselves, their self-view associated with expression, and what expression is acceptable to how I think of myself and what expression is not acceptable to how I think of myself, right? I'm not the kind of person who just bursts into tears or goes raging or is paralyzed in fear or feels weakness or terror and panic. I'm not that kind of person. And so the more rigid the sense of self, the more is considered ego dystonic. And the more flexible, realistic, and I would say spiritually accurate, spiritually real, spiritually insightful, spiritually true, the sense of self, the broader the range of what will be felt to be acceptable or able to be received and at least contemplated. So 2150, the teaching from the book, one teaching is the measure of a mind's evolution or measure of a mind's evolution or development is its ability to accept the unacceptable. So the measure or a measure of the mind's development or a soul's development is its ability to accept the unacceptable, which means to accept what previously was felt to be unacceptable, which is an expansion of the range of what's considered egocentric, and the withering away of what's felt to be ego dystonic, and even the rigidity of the sense of self. Not just this, there's the space of the sense of self, the breadth and depth, and then there's the rigidity versus flexibility that has bearing on how much we can consider or accept to consider and contemplate and look into. But in general, to the extent that there's any sense of any fixed sense of self, which is of course ignorance, avidya, and not understanding anatta, to the extent that there's any rigid sense of self, fixed sense of self, we will have preferences. And so the third patriarch in China said, the great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. It's just not too easy to get to that point of freedom from preferences. And have no preferences may even be a poor translation. Those that are not bound by preferences. So anyway, next time we're going to pick up this more and talk about ego, selflessness or anatta, ego syntonic and ego dystonic, or ego syntonicity and ego dystonicity, what's felt to be acceptable or not acceptable in harmony with or conflicting with the avidya, ignorance-based mistaken sense of self or mistake of false, fixed, rigid sense of self, and progressive freedom from that, and the basis of learning and self-directed transformation associated with expanding the realm of what's considered egocentric, or what is acceptable, or what the person, what we are willing to consider and listen to, as a critical development on the path, as the basis of healing, the basis of learning and changing and transformation. So, thank you very much for being here. I hope it was helpful. Take good care, and good night.